6. The cellar was a maze of boxes and barrels, and shrouded things hanging from hooks. Susanna had no wish to know what the dangling things were. The cry came again, a sound like sobbing and screaming mingled together. Above them, dim and muffled now, came the whoop and gasp of the wind. Roland turned to his left and threaded his way down a zigzag aisle with crates stacked head-high on either side. Susanna followed, keeping a good distance between them, looking constantly back over her shoulder. She was also alert for the sound of Oi raising the alarm from above. She saw one stack of crates that was labeled Texas Instruments and another stack with Ho Fat Chinese Fortune Cookie Company stenciled on the side. She was not surprised to see the joke name of their long-abandoned taxi. She was far beyond surprise. Ahead of her, Roland stopped. "Tears of my mother," he said in a low voice. She had heard him use this phrase once before, when they had come upon a deer that had fallen into a ravine and lay there with both back legs and one front one broken, starving and looking up at them sightlessly, for the flies had eaten the unfortunate animal's living eyes out of their sockets. She stayed where she was until he gestured for her to join him, and then moved quickly up to his right side, boosting herself along on the palms of her hands. In the stone-walled far corner of Dandolo's cellar, the southeast corner, if she had her directions right, there was a makeshift prison cell. Its door was made of crisscrossing steel bars. Nearby was the welding rig Dandolo must have used to construct it, but long ago, judging from the thick layer of dust on the acetylene tank. Hanging from an S-shaped hook, pounded into the stone wall, just out of the prisoner's reach, left close by to mock him, Susanna had no doubt, was a large and old-fashioned, dat a chum dat a chi, silver key. The prisoner in question stood at the bars of his detainment, holding his filthy hands out to them. He was so scrawny that he reminded Susanna of certain terrible concentration camp photos she had seen, images of those who had survived Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen and Buchenwald, living, if barely, indictments of mankind as a whole, with their striped uniforms hanging off them and their ghastly bellboys' pillbox hats still on their heads and their terrible bright eyes, so full of awareness. "We wish we did not know what we have become," those eyes said. "But unfortunately we do." Something like that was in Patrick Danville's eyes, as he held out his hands and made his inarticulate pleading noises. Close up, they sounded to her like the mocking cries of some jungle bird on a movie soundtrack. "Aie, aie, aiauk, aiauk." Roland took the key from its hook and went to the door. One of Danville's hands clutched at his shirt, and the gunslinger pushed it off. It was a gesture entirely without anger, she thought, but the scrawny thing in the cell backed away with his eyes bulging in their sockets. His hair was long. It hung all the way to his shoulders, but there was only the faintest haze of beard on his cheeks. It was a little thicker on his chin and upper lip. Susanna thought he might be 17, but surely not much older. "No offense, Patrick," Roland said in a purely conversational voice. He put the key in the lock. "Is thee Patrick? Is thee Patrick Danville?" The scrawny thing in the dirty jeans and billowing gray shirt, it hung nearly to his knees, backed into the corner of his triangular cell without replying. When his back was against the stone, he slid slowly to a sitting position beside what Susanna assumed was his slop bucket, the front of his shirt first bunching together and then flowing into his crotch like water as his knees rose to nearly frame his emaciated, terrified face. When Roland opened the cell door and pulled it outward as far as it would go, there were no hinges, Patrick Danville began to make the bird sound again, only this time louder. "Aie, aiauk, aie." Susanna gritted her teeth. When Roland made as if to enter the cell, the boy uttered an even louder shriek and began to beat the back of his head against the stones. Roland stepped back out of the cell. The awful head-banging ceased, but Danville looked at the stranger with fear and mistrust. Then he held out his filthy, long-fingered hands again, as if for succor. Roland looked to Susanna. She swung herself on her hands, so she was in the door of the cell. The emaciated boy thing in the corner uttered its weird bird shriek again and pulled the supplicating hands back, crossing them at the wrists, turning their gesture into one of pathetic defense.
"No, honey."
This was a deader walker Susanna had never heard before, nor suspected.
"No, honey, I ain't gonna hurt you. If I meant to do that, I'd just put two in your head like I did that motherfucker upstairs."
She saw something in his eyes. Perhaps just a minute widening that revealed more of the bloodshot whites. She smiled and nodded.
"That's right, Mr. Collins, he dead. He ain't never gonna come down here no more, and—"
"What? What'd he do to you, Patrick?"
Above them, muffled by the stone, the wind gusted. The lights flickered, the house creaked and groaned in protest.
"What'd he do to you, boy?"
It was no good, he didn't understand. She had just made up her mind to this when Patrick Danville put his hands to his stomach and held it. He twisted his face into a cramp that she realized was supposed to indicate laughter.
"He make you laugh?"
Patrick, crouched in his corner, nodded. His face twisted even more. Now his hands became fists that rose to his face. He rubbed his cheeks with them, then screwed them into his eyes, then looked at her. Susanna noticed there was a little scar on the bridge of his nose.
"He make you cry, too."
Patrick nodded. He did the laughing mime again, holding the stomach and going ho, ho, ho. He did the crying mime, wiping tears from his fuzzy cheeks. This time he added a third bit of mummery, scooping his hands toward his mouth and making smack, smack sounds with his lips. From above and slightly behind her, Roland said, "He made you laugh. He made you cry. He made you eat." Patrick shook his head so violently, it struck the stone walls that were the boundaries of his corner.
"He ate," Detta said. "That's what you're trying to say, ain't it? Dandolo ate."
Patrick nodded eagerly.
"He made you laugh, he made you cry, and then he ate what came out, 'cause that's what he do."
Patrick nodded again, bursting into tears. He made inarticulate wailing sounds. Susanna worked her way slowly into the cell, pushing herself along on her palms, ready to retreat if the headbanging started again. It didn't. When she reached the boy in the corner, he put his face against her bosom and wept. Susanna turned, looked at Roland, and told him with her eyes that he could come in now. When Patrick looked up at her, it was with dumb, dog-like adoration.
"Don't you worry," Susanna said.
Detta was gone again, probably worn out from all that nice.
"He's not going to get you, Patrick. He's dead as a doornail, dead as a stone in the river. Now I want you to do something for me. I want you to open your mouth."
Patrick shook his head at once. There was fear in his eyes again, but something else she hated to see even more. It was shame.
"Yes, Patrick. Yes, open your mouth."
He shook his head violently, his greasy long hair whipping from side to side like the head of a mop. Roland said,
"What?"
"Hush," she told him. "Open your mouth, Patrick, and show us. Then we'll take you out of here, and you'll never have to be down here again, never have to be Dandolo's dinner again."
Patrick looked at her, pleading, but Susanna only looked back at him. At last, he closed his eyes and slowly opened his mouth. His teeth were there, but his tongue was not. At some point, Dandolo must have tired of his prisoner's voice, or the words it articulated anyway, and had pulled it out. 7. 20 minutes later, the two of them stood in the kitchen doorway, watching Patrick Danville eat a bowl of soup. At least half of it was going down the boy's gray shirt, but Susanna reckoned that was all right. There was plenty of soup, and there were more shirts in the hut's only bedroom. Not to mention Joe Collins's heavy parka hung on the hook in the entry, which she expected Patrick would wear hence from here. As for the remains of Dandolo, Joe Collins that was, they had wrapped them in 3 blankets and tossed them unceremoniously out into the snow. She said Dandolo was a vampire that fed on emotions.
instead of blood. Patrick there, Patrick was his cow. There's two ways you can take nourishment from a cow, meat or milk. The trouble with meat is that once you eat the prime cuts, the not-so-prime cuts, and then the stew, it's gone. If you just take the milk, though, you can go on forever, always assuming you give the cow something to eat every now and then.
How long do you suppose he had him penned up down there? Roland asked.
I don't know. But she remembered the dust on the acetylene tank. Remembered it all too well. A fairly long time, anyway. What must have seemed like forever to him.
And it hurt.
Plenty. Much as it must have hurt when Dandolo pulled the poor kid's tongue out. I bet the emotional blood-sucking hurt more. You see how he is.
Roland saw, all right.
He saw something else as well.
We can't take him out in this storm. Even if we dressed him up in three layers of clothes, I'm sure it would kill him.
Susanna nodded. She was sure, too. Of that and something else. She could not stay in the house. That might kill her.
Roland agreed when she said so.
We'll camp out in yonder barn until the storm finishes. It'll be cold, but I see a pair of possible gains. Mordred may come, and Lippy may come back.
You'd kill them both?
Aye, if I could. Do ye have a problem with that?
She considered it, then shook her head.
All right. Let's put together what we take out there, for we'll have no fire for the next 2 days at least. Maybe as long as four.
8. It turned out to be 3 nights and 2 days before the blizzard choked on its own fury and blew itself out. Near dusk of the second day, Lippy came limping out of the storm, and Roland put a bullet in the blind shovel that was her head. Mordred never showed himself, although she had a sense of him lurking close on the second night. Perhaps Oi did, too, for he stood at the mouth of the barn, barking hard into the blowing snow. During that time, Susanna found out a good deal more about Patrick Danville than she had expected. His mind had been badly damaged by his period of captivity, and that did not surprise her. What did was his capacity for recovery, limited though it might be. She wondered if she herself could have come back at all after such an ordeal. Perhaps his talent had something to do with it. She had seen his talent for herself, in Sayre's office. Dandolo had given his captive the bare minimum of food necessary to keep him alive, and had stolen emotions from him on a regular basis, 2 times a week, sometimes 3, once in a while even 4. Each time, Patrick became convinced that the next time would kill him, someone would happen by. Just lately, Patrick had been spared the worst of Dandolo's depredations because company had been more frequent than ever before. Roland told her later that night, after they'd bedded down in the hayloft, that he believed many of Dandolo's most recent victims must have been exiles fleeing either from Lacasse Royrus or the town around it. Susanna could certainly sympathize with the thinking of such refugees. The king is gone, so let's get the hell out of here while the getting's good. After all, Big Red might take it into his head to come back. And he's off his chump, round the bend, possessed of an elevator that no longer goes to the top floor. On some occasions, Joe had assumed his true Dandolo form in front of his prisoner, then had eaten the boy's resulting terror. But he had wanted much more than terror from his captive cow. Susanna guessed that different emotions must produce different flavors, like having pork one day, chicken the next, and fish the day after that. Patrick couldn't talk, but he could gesture. And he could do more than that once Roland showed them a queer find he'd come upon in the pantry. On one of the highest shelves was a stack of oversized drawing pads marked Michelangelo, fine for charcoal. They had no charcoal, but near the pads was a clutch of brand new Eberhard Faber No. 2 pencils held together by a rubber band. What qualified the find as especially queer was the fact that someone, presumably Dandolo, had carefully cut the eraser off the top of each pencil. These were stored in a canning jar next to the pencils, along with a few paper clips and a pencil sharpener that looked like the whistles on the undersides of the few remaining Oriza plates from Calibrin Sturgis. When Patrick saw the pads, his ordinarily dull eyes lit up, and he stretched both hands longingly toward them, making urgent hooting sounds. Roland looked at Susanna, who shrugged and said, "Let's see what he can do. I have a pretty good idea already. Don't you?" It turned out that he could do a lot. Patrick Danville's drawing ability was nothing short of amazing, and his pictures gave him all the voice he needed. He produced them rapidly and with clear pleasure. He did not seem disturbed at all by their harrowing clarity. One showed Joe Collins chopping into the back of an unsuspecting visitor's head with a hatchet, his lips pulled back in a snarling grin of pleasure. Beside the point of impact, the boy had printed "Chunt" and "Sploosh" in big comic book letters. Above Collins's head, Patrick drew a thought balloon with the words, "Take that, you lunker," in it. Another picture showed Patrick himself lying on the floor, reduced to helplessness by laughter that was depicted with terrible accuracy, no need of the "ha, ha, ha" scrawled above his head, while Collins stood over him with his hands on his hips, watching. Patrick then tossed back the sheet of paper with that drawing on it, and quickly produced another picture which showed Collins on his knees, with one hand twined in Patrick's hair, while his pursed lips hovered in front of Patrick's laughing, agonized mouth. Quickly, in a single practiced movement, the tip of the pencil never left the paper, the boy made another comic strip thought balloon over the old man's head, and then put 7 letters and 2 exclamation points inside.
"What does it say?"
Roland asked, fascinated.
"Yum. Good," Susanna answered. Her voice was small and sickened.
Subject matter aside, she could have watched him draw for hours. In fact, she did. The speed of the pencil was eerie, and neither of them ever thought to give him one of the amputated erasers, for there seemed to be no need. So far as Susanna could see, the boy either never made a mistake or incorporated the mistakes into his drawings in a way that made them, well, why stick at the words if they were the right words, little acts of genius. And the resulting pictures weren't sketches, not really, but finished works of art in themselves. She knew what Patrick, this one or another Patrick from another world, along the path of the beam, would later be capable of with oil paints. And such knowledge made her feel cold and hot at the same time. What did they have here? A tongueless Rembrandt? It occurred to her that this was their second idiot savant. Their third, if you counted Oi as well as Shimi. Only once did his lack of interest in the erasers cross Susanna's mind, and she put it down to the arrogance of genius. Not a single time did it occur to her, or to Roland, that this young version of Patrick Danville might not yet know that such things as erasers even existed. 9. Near the end of the third night, Susanna awoke in the loft, looked at Patrick lying asleep beside her, and descended the ladder. Roland was standing in the doorway of the barn, smoking a cigarette and looking out. The snow had stopped. A late moon had made its appearance, turning the fresh snow on Tower Road into a sparkling land of silent beauty. The air was still and so cold she felt the moisture in her nose crackle. Far in the distance, she heard the sound of a motor. As she listened, it seemed to her that it was drawing closer. She asked Roland if he had any idea what it was or what it might mean to them.
"I think it's likely the robot he called Stuttering Bill, out doing his after-storm plowing," he said. "He may have one of those antenna things on his head, like the wolves, you remember?" She remembered very well, and said so. "It may be that he holds some special allegiance to Dandolo," Roland said. "I don't think that's likely. But it wouldn't be the strangest thing I ever ran across. Be ready with one of your plates if he shows red, and I'll be ready with my gun."
"But you don't think so?"
She wanted to be 100% clear on this point.
"No," Roland said. "He could give us a ride. Perhaps all the way to the tower itself. Even if not, he might take us to the far edge of the White Lands. That would be good for the boy still weak."
This raised a question in her mind. "We call him the boy because he looks like a boy," she said. "How old do you think he is?"
Roland shook his head. "Surely no younger than 16 or 17, but he might be as old as 30. Time was strange when the beams were under attack, and it took strange hops and twists, I can attest to that.
Did Stephen King put him in our way?
I can't say. Only that he knew of him, sure.
He paused.
The tower is so close. Do you feel it?
She did, and all the time. Sometimes it was a pulsing, sometimes it was singing, quite often it was both. And the Polaroid still hung in Dandolo's hut. That, at least, had not been part of the glamour. Each night in her dreams, at least once, she saw the tower in that photograph standing at the end of its field of roses, sooty gray-black stone against a troubled sky where the clouds streamed out in four directions along the two beams that still held. She knew what the voices sang, "Kamala, Kamala, Kamala, come, come." But she did not think that they sang to her, or for her. No, say never in life. This was Roland's song, and Roland's alone. But she had begun to hope that that didn't necessarily mean she was going to die between here and the end of her quest. She had been having her own dreams. 10. Less than an hour after the sun rose, firmly in the east, and we all say thank you, an orange vehicle, combination truck and bulldozer, appeared over the horizon and came slowly but steadily toward them, pushing a big wing of fresh snow to its right, making the high bank even higher on that side. Susanna guessed that when it reached the intersection of Tower Road and Odd Lane, Stuttering Bill, almost surely the plow's operator, would swing it around and plow back the other way. Maybe he stopped here, as a rule, not for coffee, but for a fresh squirt of oil or something. She smiled at the idea, and at something else as well. There was a loudspeaker mounted on the cab's roof, and a rock and roll song she actually knew was issuing forth. Susanna laughed, delighted.
"California sun, the Rivieras, oh, doesn't it sound fine?"
"If you say so," Roland agreed. "Just keep hold of thy plate."
"You can count on that," she said.
Patrick had joined them. As always, since Roland had found them in the pantry, he had a pad and a pencil. Now he wrote a single word in capital letters and held it out to Susanna, knowing that Roland could read very little of what he wrote, even if it was printed in letters that were big, big. The word in the lower quadrant of the sketchpad was Bill. This was below an amazing drawing of Oi with a comic-stripped speech balloon over his head reading, "Yark, Yark." All this he had casually crossed out so she wouldn't think it was what he wanted her to look at. The slashed X sort of broke her heart, because the picture beneath its crossed lines was Oi to the life. 11. The plow pulled up in front of Dandolo's hut, and although the engine continued to run, the music cut off. Down from the driver's seat there galumphed a tall, 8 feet at the very least, shiny-headed robot who looked quite a lot like Nigel from the Arc 16 experimental station and Andy from Colubrin Sturgis. He cocked his metal arms and put his metal hands on his hips in a way that would likely have reminded Eddie of George Lucas's C-3PO had Eddie been there. The robot spoke in an amplified voice that rolled away across the snowfields. "Hello, Joe. What do you know? How are tricks in Kokomo?" Roland stepped out of the late Lippy's quarters.
"I'll Bill," he said mildly. "Long days and pleasant nights."
The robot turned. His eyes flashed bright blue. That looked like surprise to Susanna. He showed no alarm that she could see, however, and didn't appear to be armed. But she had already marked the antenna rising from the center of his head, twirling and twirling in the bright morning light, and she felt confident she could clip it with an Ariza if she needed to. "Easy peasy Japanesey," Eddie would have said.
"Ah," said the robot, "a-gudda-ga-gunna-ga-gu-gu-gu."
He raised an arm that had not one elbow joint but two, and smacked his head with it. From inside came a little whistling noise, reep, and then he finished. A gunslinger! Susanna laughed. She couldn't help it. They had come all this way to meet an oversized electronic version of Porky Pig.
That's all, folks.
I had heard rumors of such on the l-l-l-land, the robot said, ignoring her laughter. Are you Roland of Gilead?
So I am, Roland said. And you?
William D-746541M, maintenance robot. Many other functions. Joe Collins calls me Stuttering Bill. I've got a fried circuit somewhere inside. I could fix it, but he forbade me. And since he's the only human around, or was... He stopped. Susanna could quite clearly hear the clitter-clack of relays somewhere inside in what she thought of wasn't C-3PO, who she'd of course never seen, but Robbie the robot from Forbidden Planet. Then, Stuttering Bill quite touched her heart by putting one metal hand to his forehead and bowing. But not to either her or to Roland. He said, "Heil, Patrick de Danville, son of Sonia. It's good to see you out and in the clear, so it is." And Susanna could hear the emotion in Stuttering Bill's voice. It was genuine gladness, and she felt more than okay about lowering her plate. 12. They palavered in the yard. Bill would have been quite willing to go into the hut, for he had but rudimentary olfactory equipment. The Humes were better equipped and knew that the hut stank and had not even warmth to recommend it, for the furnace and the fire were both out. In any case, the palaver didn't take long. William, the maintenance robot, many other functions, had counted the being that sometimes called itself Joe Collins as his master, for there was no longer anyone else to lay claim to the job. Besides, Collins Dandolo had the necessary code words. I was not able to give him the code words when he asked, said Stuttering Bill. But my programming did not prohibit bringing him certain manuals that had the information he needed.
Bureaucracy is so wonderful, Susanna said.
Bill said he had stayed away from Joe as often and as long as he could. Although he had to come when Tower Road needed plowing, that was also in his programming, and once a month to bring provisions, canned goods mostly, from what he called the Federal. He also liked to see Patrick, who had once given Bill a wonderful picture of himself that he looked at often and of which he had made many copies. Yet every time he came, he confided, he was sure he would find Patrick gone, killed, and thrown casually into the woods, somewhere back toward what Bill called the bads, like an old piece of trash. But now here he was, alive and free, and Bill was delighted. "For I do have rudimentary emotions," he said, sounding to Susanna like someone owning up to a bad habit.
"Do you need the code words from us, in order to accept our orders?" Roland asked.
"Yes, Stuttering Bill said.
"Shit," Susanna muttered.
They had had similar problems with Andy back in Caliburn Sturgis. However, said Stuttering Bill, if you were to couch your orders as suggestions, I'm sure I'd be...
He raised his arm and smacked his head again. The whoop sound came once more, not from his mouth, but from the region of his chest, Susanna thought.
"Happy to oblige," he finished.
"My first suggestion is that you fix that fucking stutter," Roland said, and then turned around, amazed. Patrick had collapsed to the snow, holding his belly and voicing great, blurry cries of laughter. Oi danced around him, barking, but Oi was harmless. This time, there was no one to steal Patrick's joy. It belonged only to him, and to those lucky enough to hear it. 13. In the woods beyond the plowed intersection, back toward what Bill would have called the Bads, a shivering adolescent boy, wrapped in stinking, half-scraped hides, watched the quartet standing in front of Dandolo's hut.
"Die," he thought at them. "Die. Why don't you all do me a favor and just die?"
But they didn't die, and the cheerful sound of their laughter cut him like knives. Later, after they had all piled into the cab of Bill's plow and driven away, Mordred crept down to the hut. There he would stay for at least 2 days, eating his fill from the cans in Dandolo's pantry, and eating something else as well, something he would live to regret. He spent those days regaining his strength, for the big storm had come close to killing him. He believed it was his hate that had kept him alive. That, and no more. Or perhaps it was the tower, for he felt it too, that pulse, that singing. But what Roland and Susanna and Patrick heard in a major key, Mordred heard in a minor. And where they heard many voices, he heard only one. It was the voice of his red father telling him to come, telling him to kill the mute boy and the blackbird bitch and especially the gunslinger out of Gilead, the uncaring white daddy who had left him behind. Of course, his red daddy had also left him behind, but this never crossed Mordred's mind. And when the killing was done, the whispering voice promised, they would destroy the Dark Tower and rule Todash together for eternity. So Mordred ate, for Mordred was a-hungry. And Mordred slept, for Mordred was a-weary. And when Mordred dressed himself in Dandolo's warm clothes, and set out along the freshly ploughed tower road, pulling a rich sack of gunna on a sled behind him, canned goods mostly, he had become a young man who looked to be perhaps 20 years old, tall and straight, and as fair as a summer sunrise, his human form marked only by the scar on his side where Susanna's bullet had winged him, and the blood mark on his heel. That heel, he had promised himself, would rest on Roland's throat. And soon.
Part 5. The Scarlet Field of Can Canore. Chapter 1. The Sore and the Door. Goodbye, my dear. 1. In the final days of their long journey, after Bill, just Bill now, no longer Stuttering Bill, dropped them off at the Federal on the edge of the White Lands, Susanna Dean began to suffer frequent bouts of weeping. She would feel these impending cloudbursts, and would excuse herself from the others, saying she had to go into the bushes and do her necessary. And there she would sit, on a fallen tree, or perhaps just the cold ground, put her hands over her face, and let her tears flow. If Roland knew this was happening, and surely he must have noted her red eyes when she returned to the road, he made no comment. She supposed he knew what she did. Her time in Midworld and Endworld was almost at an end. 2. Bill took them in his fine orange plow to a lonely Quonset hut with a faded sign out front reading, Federal Outpost 19, Tower Watch, Travel Beyond This Point is Forbidden. She supposed Federal Outpost 19 was still technically in the White Lands of Empathica, but the air had warmed considerably as Tower Road descended and the snow on the ground was little more than a scrim. Groves of trees dotted the ground ahead, but Susanna thought the land would soon be almost entirely open, like the prairies of the American Midwest. There were bushes that probably supported berries in warm weather, perhaps even pokeberries, but now they were bare and clattering in the nearly constant wind. Mostly what they saw on either side of Tower Road, which had once been paved, but had now been reduced to little more than a pair of broken ruts, were tall grasses poking out of the thin snow cover. They whispered in the wind, and Susanna knew their song, Kamala, come, come, journey's almost done. I may go no further, Bill said, shutting down the plow and cutting off little Richard in mid-rave. Tell you sorry, as they say in the Ark of the Borderlands. Their trip had taken one full day and half of another, and during that time he had entertained them with a constant stream of what he called golden oldies. Some of these were not old at all to Susanna. Songs like Sugar Shack and Heat Wave had been current hits on the radio when she'd returned from her little vacation in Mississippi. Others she had never heard at all. The music was stored not on records or tapes, but on beautiful silver discs Bill called CDs. He pushed them into a slot in the plow's instrument-cluttered dashboard, and the music played from at least 8 different speakers. Any music would have sounded fine to her, she supposed, but she was especially taken by 2 songs she had never heard before. One was a deliriously happy little rocker called She Loves You. The other, sad and reflective, was called Hey Jude. Roland actually seemed to know the latter one. He sang along with it, although the words he knew were different from the ones coming out of the plow's multiple speakers. When she asked, Bill told her the group was called The Beatles.
Funny name for a rock and roll band, Susanna said.
Patrick, sitting with Oi in the plow's tiny rear seat, tapped her on the shoulder. She turned, and he held up the pad through which he was currently working his way. Beneath a picture of Roland in profile, he had printed B-E-A-T-L-E-S, not B-E-E-T-L-E-S. It's a funny name for a rock and roll band, no matter which way you spell it, Susanna said, and that gave her an idea.
Patrick, do you have the touch?
When he frowned and raised his hands, I don't understand, the gesture said. She rephrased the question.
Can you read my mind?
He shrugged and smiled. This gesture said, I don't know, but she thought Patrick did know. She thought he knew very well. 3. They reached the Federal near noon, and there Bill served them a fine meal. Patrick wolfed his and then sat off to one side with Oi curled at his feet, sketching the others as they sat around the table in what had once been the common room. The walls of this room were covered with TV screens. Susanna guessed there were 300 or more. They must have been built to last, too, because some were still operating. A few showed the rolling hills surrounding the Quonset, but most broadcast only snow. And one showed a series of rolling lines that made her feel queasy in her stomach if she looked at it too long. The snow screens, Bill said, had once shown pictures from satellites in orbit around the Earth, but the cameras in those had gone dead long ago. The one with the rolling lines was more interesting. Bill told them that, until only a few months ago, that one had shown the Dark Tower. Then, suddenly, the picture had dissolved into nothing but those lines.
I don't think the Red King liked being on television, Bill told them, especially if he knew company might be coming. Won't you have another sandwich? There are plenty, I assure you. No? Soup, then? What about you, Patrick? You're too thin, you know. Far, far too thin.
Patrick turned his pad around and showed them a picture of Bill bowing in front of Susanna, a tray of neatly cut sandwiches in one metal hand, a carafe of iced tea in the other. Like all of Patrick's pictures, it went far beyond caricature, yet had been produced with a speed of hand that was eerie. Susanna applauded. Roland smiled and nodded. Patrick grinned, holding his teeth together so that the others wouldn't have to look at the empty hole behind them. Then he tossed the sheet back and began something new.
There's a fleet of vehicles out back, Bill said, and while many of them no longer run, some still do. I can give you a truck with 4-wheel drive, and while I cannot assure you it will run smoothly, I believe you can count on it to take you as far as the Dark Tower, which is no more than 120 wheels from here.
Susanna felt a great and fluttery lift drop in her stomach. 120 wheels was 100 miles, perhaps even a bit less. They were close. So close it was scary.
You would not want to come upon the tower after dark, Bill said. At least I shouldn't think so, considering the new resident. But what's one more night camped at the side of the road to such great travelers as yourselves? Not much, I should say. But even with one last night on the road, and barring breakdowns, which the gods know are always possible, you'd have your goal in sight by mid-morning of tomorrow day.
Roland considered this long and carefully. Susanna had to tell herself to breathe while he did so, because part of her didn't want to. I'm not ready, that part thought. And there was a deeper part, a part that remembered every nuance of what had become a recurring and evolving dream, that thought something else. I'm not meant to go at all. Not all the way. At last, Roland said,
I thank you, Bill. We all say thank you, I'm sure. But I think we'll pass on your kind offer. Were you to ask me why, I couldn't say, only that part of me thinks that tomorrow day's too soon. That part of me thinks we should go the rest of the way on foot, just as we've already traveled so far. He took a deep breath, let it out. I'm not ready to be there yet. Not quite ready.
You too, Susanna marveled. You too.
I need a little more time to prepare my mind and my heart, mayhap even my soul. He reached into his back pocket and brought out the photocopy of the Robert Browning poem that had been left for them in Dandolo's medicine chest. There's something written here about remembering the old times before coming to the last battle, or the last stand. It's well said, and perhaps really all I need is what this poet speaks of. A draft of earlier, happier sights. I don't know. But unless Susanna objects, I believe we'll go on foot.
Susanna doesn't object, she said quietly. Susanna thinks it's just what the doctor ordered. Susanna only objects to being dragged along behind like a busted tailpipe.
Roland gave her a grateful, if distracted, smile. He seemed to have gone away from her somehow during these last few days, and then turned back to Bill. I wonder if you have a cart I could pull, for we'll have to take at least some gunner, and there's Patrick. He'll have to ride part of the time.
Patrick looked indignant. He cocked an arm in front of him, made a fist, and flexed his muscle. The result, a tiny goose egg rising on the biceps of his drawing arm, seemed to shame him, for he dropped it quickly. Susanna smiled and reached out to pat his knee. Don't look like that, sugar. It's not your fault that you spent God knows how long caged up like Hansel and Gretel in the witch's house.
I'm sure I have such a thing, Bill said, and a battery-powered version for Susanna. What I don't have, I can make. It would take an hour or two at most.
Roland was calculating. If we leave here with 5 hours of daylight ahead of us, we might be able to make 12 wheels by sunset, what Susanna would call 9 or 10 miles. Another 5 days at that rather leisurely speed would bring us to the tower I've spent my life searching for. I'd come to it around sunset if possible, for that's when I've always seen it in my dreams. Susanna? And the voice inside, that deep voice, whispered,
4 nights. 4 nights to dream. That should be enough. Maybe more than enough.
Of course, Ka would have to intervene. If they had indeed outrun its influence, that couldn't happen. But Susanna now thought Ka reached everywhere, even to the Dark Tower, was perhaps embodied by the Dark Tower.
That's fine, she told him in a faint voice.
Patrick? Roland asked. What do you say? Patrick shrugged and flipped a hand in their direction, hardly looking up from his pad.
Whatever they wanted, that gesture said.
Susanna guessed that Patrick understood little about the Dark Tower and cared less. And why would he care? He was free of the monster, and his belly was full. Those things were enough for him. He had lost his tongue, but he could sketch to his heart's content. She was sure that to Patrick that seemed like more than an even trade.
And yet, he's not meant to go either. Not him, not Oi, not me. But what is to become of us then?
She didn't know, but she was queerly unworried about it. Ka would tell. Ka and her dreams. 4. An hour later, the three Humes, the Bumbler, and Bill the Robot stood clustered around a cut-down wagon that looked like a slightly larger version of Hofat's luxury taxi. The wheels were tall but thin and spun like a dream. Even when it was full, Susanna thought it would be like pulling a feather, at least while Roland was fresh. Pulling it uphill would undoubtedly rob him of his energy after a while, but as they ate the food they were carrying, Hofat, too, would grow lighter still, and she thought there wouldn't be many hills anyway. They had come to the open lands, the prairie lands, all the snow and tree-covered ridges were behind them. Bill had provided her with an electric runabout that was more scooter than golf cart,
Her days of being dragged along behind, like a busted tailpipe, were done. "If you'll give me another half an hour, I can smooth this off," Bill said, running a three-fingered steel hand along the edge where he had cut off the front half of the small wagon that was now Hofat II.
"We say thank you, but it won't be necessary," Roland said. "We'll lay a couple of hides over it just so."
He's impatient to be off, Susanna thought. And after all this time, why wouldn't he be? I'm anxious to be off myself.
"Well, if you say so, let it be so," Bill said, sounding unhappy about it. "I suppose I just hate to see you go. When will I see Humes again?"
None of them answered that. They didn't know.
"There's a mighty loud horn on the roof," Bill said, pointing at the Federal. "I don't know what sort of trouble it was meant to signal, radiation leaks, mayhap, or some sort of attack, but I do know the sound of it will carry across 100 wheels at least. More, if the wind's blowing in the right direction. If I should see the fellow you think is following you, or if such motion sensors as still work pick him up, I'll set it off. Perhaps you'll hear."
"Thank you," Roland said.
"Were you to drive, you could outrun him easily," Bill pointed out. "You'd reach the tower and never have to see him."
"That's true enough," Roland said, but he showed absolutely no sign of changing his mind, and Susanna was glad.
"What will you do about the one you call his Red Father, if he really does command Kankanore?"
Roland shook his head, although he had discussed this probability with Susanna. He thought they might be able to circle the tower from a distance, and come then to its base from a direction that was blind to the balcony on which the Crimson King was trapped. Then they could work their way around to the door beneath him. They wouldn't know if that was possible until they could actually see the tower and the lay of the land, of course.
"Well, there'll be water if God wills it," said the robot, formerly known as Stuttering Bill. "Or so the old people did say. And mayhap I'll see you again, in the clearing at the end of the path, if nowhere else. If robots are allowed to go there. I hope it's so, for there's many I've known that I'd see again."
He sounded so forlorn that Susanna went to him and raised her arms to be picked up, not thinking about the absurdity of wanting to hug a robot. But he did, and she did, quite fervently, too. Bill made up for the malicious Andy back in Colibrin Sturgis, and was worth hugging for that if nothing else. As his arms closed around her, it occurred to Susanna that Bill could break her in two with those titanium steel arms if he wanted to. But he didn't. He was gentle.
"Long days and pleasant nights, Bill," she said. "May you do well, and we all say so."
"Thank you, madam," he said, and put her down. "I say thutta thank, thumma thank, thukka weep,"
and he struck his head, producing a bright clang.
"I say thank you kindly."
He paused.
"I did fix the stutter, say true, but as I may have told you, I am not entirely without emotions."
5. Patrick surprised them both by walking for almost 4 hours beside Susanna's electric scooter before tiring and climbing into Hofat II. They listened for the horn, warning them that Bill had seen Mordred, or that the instruments in the Federal had detected him, but did not hear it, and the wind was blowing their way. By sunset, they had left the last of the snow. The land continued to flatten out, casting their shadows long before them. When they finally stopped for the night, Roland gathered enough brush for a fire, and Patrick, who had dozed off, woke up long enough to eat an enormous meal of Vienna sausage and baked beans. Susanna, watching the beans disappear into Patrick's tongueless mouth, reminded herself to spread her hides upwind of him when she finally laid down her weary head. She and Oi also ate heartily, but Roland hardly touched his own food. When dinner was done, Patrick took up his pad to draw, frowned at his pencil,
and then held out a hand to Susanna. She knew what he wanted, and took the glass canning jar from the little bag of personals she kept slung over her shoulder. She held onto this because there was only the one pencil sharpener, and she was afraid that Patrick might lose it. Of course, Roland could sharpen the Eberhard Fabers with his knife, but it would change the quality of the points somewhat. She tipped the jar, spilling erasers and paper clips and the required object into her cupped palm. Then she handed it to Patrick, who sharpened his pencil with a few quick twists, handed it back, and immediately fell to his work. For a moment, Susanna looked at the pink erasers and wondered again why Dandolo had bothered to cut them off. As a way of teasing the boy? If so, it hadn't worked. Later in life, perhaps, when the sublime connections between his brain and his fingers rusted a little, when the small but undeniably brilliant world of his talent had moved on, he might require erasers, for now even his mistakes continued to be inspirations. He didn't draw long. When Susanna saw him nodding over his pad in the orange glare of the fading sunset, she took it from his unprotesting fingers, bedded him down in the back of the cart, propped level with the front end on a convenient boulder jutting from the ground, covered him with hides, and kissed his cheek. Sleepily, Patrick reached up and touched the sore below her own cheek. She winced, then held steady at his gentle touch. The sore had clotted over again, but it throbbed painfully. Even smiling hurt her these days. The hand fell away, and Patrick slept. The stars had come out. Roland was looking raptly up at them. "What do you see?" she asked him.
"What do you see?" he asked in turn.
She looked at the brightening celestial landscape. "Well," she said, "there's Old Star and Old Mother, but they seem to have moved west. And that there, oh my goodness!" She placed her hands on his stubbly cheeks. He never seemed to grow an actual beard, only a bristly scruff, and turned it. "That wasn't there, back when we left from the Western Sea. I know it wasn't. That one's in our world, Roland. We call it the Big Dipper." He nodded.
"And once, according to the oldest books in my father's library, it was in the sky of our world as well. Lydia's Dipper, it was called. And now here it is again."
He turned to her, smiling.
"Another sign of life and renewal. How the Crimson King must hate to look up from his entrapment and see it riding the sky again."
6. Not long after, Susanna slept and dreamed. 7. She's in Central Park again, under a bright gray sky from which the first few snowflakes are once more drifting. Carolers nearby are singing not Silent Night or What Child Is This, but the Rice Song. "Rice be a green, oh, see what we seen, oh, seen, oh, the green, oh, come, come, Kamala." She takes off her cap, afraid it will have changed somehow, but it still says Merry Christmas, and, no twins here, she is comforted. She looks around, and there stand Eddie and Jake, grinning at her. Their heads are bare. She has gotten their hats. She has combined their hats. Eddie is wearing a sweatshirt that says, "I drink Nozzle." Jake is wearing one that says, "I drive the Takuro Spirit." None of this is precisely new. What she sees behind them, standing near a carriage path leading back to Fifth Avenue, most certainly is. It's a door, about 6.5 feet high, and made of solid ironwood from the look of it. The doorknob's of solid gold, and filigreed with a shape the lady gunslinger finally recognizes. 2 crossed pencils. Eberhard Faber number 2's, she has no doubt. And the erasers have been cut off. Eddie holds out a cup of hot chocolate. It's the perfect kind, mit Schlag on top, and a little sprinkling of nutmeg dotting the cream. "Here," he says, "I brought you hot chocolate." She ignores the outstretched cup. She's fascinated by the door. "It's like the ones along the beach, isn't it?" she asks. "Yes," Eddie says. "No," Jake says at the same time. "You'll figure it out," they say together, and grin at each other delighted. She walks past them. Writ upon the doors through which Roland drew them were the prisoner and the lady of shadows and the pusher. Writ upon this one are hieroglyphics, and below them, the artist. She turns back to them, and they are gone. Central Park is gone. She is looking at the ruination of Ludd, gazing upon the wastelands. On a cold and bitter breeze, she hears four whispered words. Time's almost up. Hurry. 8. She woke in a kind of panic, thinking, I have to leave him, and best I do it before I can so much as see his dark tower on the horizon. But where do I go, and how can I leave him to face both Mordred and the Crimson King with only Patrick to help him? This idea caused her to reflect on a bitter certainty. Come a showdown, Oi would almost certainly be more valuable to Roland than Patrick. The Bumbler had proved his mettle on more than one occasion, and would have been worthy of the title gunslinger had he but a gun to sling and a hand to sling it with. Patrick, though, Patrick was a, well, a pencil slinger. Faster than blue blazes, but you couldn't kill much with an Eberhard Faber unless it was very sharp. She'd sat up. Roland, leaning against the far side of her little scooter and keeping the watch, hadn't noticed. And she didn't want him to notice. That would lead to questions. She lay back down, pulling her hides around her and thinking of their first hunt. She remembered how the yearling buck had swerved and run right at her, and how she'd decapitated it with the oryza. She remembered the whistling sound in the chilly air, the one that resulted when the wind blew through the little attachment on the bottom of the plate, the attachment that looked so much like Patrick's pencil sharpener. She thought her mind was trying to make some sort of connection here, but she was too tired to know what it might be. And maybe she was trying too hard as well. If so, what was she to do about that? There was at least one thing she did know from her time in Colibrin Sturgis. The meaning of the symbols writ upon the door was unfound. Time's almost up. Hurry. The next day, her tears began. 9. There were still plenty of bushes behind which she could go to do her necessary, and cry her tears when she could no longer hold them back. But the land continued to flatten and open. Around noon of their second full day on the road, Susanna saw what she at first thought was a cloud shadow moving across the land far up ahead, only the sky above was solid blue from horizon to horizon. Then the great dark patch began to veer in a very uncloud-like way. She caught her breath and brought her little electric scooter to a stop. Roland, she said, yonder's a herd of buffalo, or maybe they're bison, sure as death and taxes.
Aye, do you say so? Roland asked with only passing interest. We called them Bannock in the long ago. It's a good-sized herd.
Patrick was standing in the back of Hofat too, sketching madly. He switched his grip on the pencil he was using, now holding the yellow barrel against his palm and shading with the tip. She could almost smell the dust boiling up from the herd as he shaded it with his pencil. Although it seemed to her that he'd taken the liberty of moving the herd 5 or even 10 miles closer, unless his vision was a good deal sharper than her own. That, she supposed, was entirely possible. In any case, her eyes had adjusted and she could see them better herself. Their great shaggy heads, even their black eyes. There hasn't been a herd of buffalo that size in America for almost 100 years, she said.
Aye? Still only polite interest. But they're in plenty here, I should say. If a little tet of them comes within pistol-shot range, let's take a couple. I'd like to taste some fresh meat that isn't deer, would you?
She let her smile answer for her. Roland smiled back. And it occurred to her again that soon she would see him no more. This man, she'd believed, was either a mirage or a demon before she had come to know him both Antet and Dandine. Eddie was dead, Jake was dead, and soon she would see Roland of Gilead no more. Would he be dead as well? Would she? She looked up into the glare of the sun,
wanting him to mistake the reason for her tears if he saw them. And they moved on into the southeast of that great and empty land, into the ever-strengthening beat, beat, beat that was the tower at the axis of all worlds and time itself. Beat, beat, beat. Kamala, come, come. Journey's almost done. That night she stood the first watch, then awakened Roland at midnight.
I think he's out there someplace, she said, pointing into the northwest.
There was no need to be more specific. It could only be Mordred. Everyone else was gone.
Watch well.
I will, he said. And if you hear a gunshot, wake well and fast.
You can count on it, said she,
and lay down in the dry winter grass behind Hofat Too. At first, she wasn't sure she'd be able to sleep. She was still jazzed from the sense of an unfriendly other in the vicinity. But she did sleep, and dreamed. 10. The dream of the second night is both like and unlike the dream of the first. The main elements are exactly the same. Central Park, gray sky, spits of snow, choral voices, this time harmonizing Come Go With Me, the old Del Vikings hit. Jake, I drive the Takuro Spirit, and Eddie, this time wearing a sweatshirt reading, Click, it's a Shinaro camera. Eddie has hot chocolate, but doesn't offer it to her. She can see the anxiety, not only in their faces, but in the tensed upset of their bodies. That is the main difference in this dream. There is something to see, or something to do, or perhaps it's both. Whatever it is, they expected her to see it or do it by now, and she is being backward. A rather terrible question occurs to her. Is she being purposely backward? Is there something here she doesn't want to confront? Could it even be possible that the Dark Tower is fucking up communications? Surely that's a stupid idea. These people she sees are but figments of her longing imagination, after all. They are dead. Eddie killed by a bullet, Jake as a result of being run over by a car, one slain in this world, one in the Keystone world, where fun is fun and done is done. Must be done, for there time always runs in one direction, and Stephen King is their poet laureate. Yet she cannot deny that look on their faces, that look of panic that seems to tell her, you have it, Suze, you have what we want to show you, you have what you need to know. Are you going to let it slip away? It's the fourth quarter, it's the fourth quarter, and the clock is ticking, and will continue to tick, must continue to tick, because all your timeouts are gone. You have to hurry. Hurry! 11. She snapped awake with a gasp. It was almost dawn. She wiped a hand across her brow, and it came away wet with sweat.
What do you want me to know, Eddie? What is it you'd have me know?
To this question there was no answer. How could there be?
Mr. Dean, he dayed, she thought, and lay back down.
She lay that way for another hour, but couldn't get back to sleep. 12. Like Hofat 1, Hofat 2 was equipped with handles. Unlike those on Hofat 1, these handles were adjustable. When Patrick felt like walking, the handles could be moved apart, so he could pull one and Roland the other. When Patrick felt like riding, Roland moved the handles together so he could pull on his own. They stopped at noon for a meal. When it was done, Patrick crawled into the back of Hofat 2 for a snooze. Roland waited until he heard the boy, for so they continued to think of him, no matter what his age, snoring, then turned to her.
What fash is thee, Susanna? I'd have you tell me. I'd have you tell me, Dan Dean, even though there's no longer a Tet, and I'm your Dean no more.
He smiled. The sadness in that smile broke her heart, and she could hold her tears back no more, nor the truth.
If I'm still with you when we see your tower, Roland, things have gone all wrong.
How wrong? He asked her.
She shook her head, beginning to weep harder.
There's supposed to be a door. It's the unfound door, but I don't know how to find it. Eddie and Jake come to me in my dreams and tell me, I know. They tell me with their eyes, but I don't. I swear I don't.
He took her in his arms and held her and kissed the hollow of her temple.
At the corner of her mouth, the sore throbbed and burned. It wasn't bleeding, but it had begun to grow again.
"Let be what will be," said the gunslinger, as his own mother had once told him. "Let be what will be, and hush, and let Kaa work."
"You said we'd outrun it." He rocked her in his arms, rocked her. And it was good. It was soothing.
"I was wrong," he said, "as thee knows."
13. It was her turn to watch early on the third night, and she was looking back behind them, northwest along the tower road, when a hand grasped her shoulder. Terror sprang up in her mind like a jack-in-the-box, and she whirled. "He's behind me. Oh, dear God, Mordred's got around behind me, and it's the spider." With her hand going to the gun in her belt and yanking it free, Patrick recoiled from her, his own face long with terror, raising his hands in front of him. If he'd cried out, he would surely have awakened Roland, and then everything might have been different. But he was too frightened to cry out. He made a low sound in his throat, and that was all. She put the gun back, showed him her empty hands, then pulled him to her and hugged him. At first he was stiff against her, still afraid, but after a little he relaxed.
"What is it, darling?" she asked him, sotto voce.
Then, using Roland's phrase, without even realizing it,
"What fashes thee?"
He pulled away from her and pointed dead north. For a moment she still didn't understand, and then she saw the orange lights dancing and darting. She judged they were at least 5 miles away, and she could hardly believe she hadn't seen them before. Still speaking low, so as not to wake Roland, she said,
"They're nothing but fool lights, sugar. They can't hurt you.
Roland calls them Hobbs.
They're like St. Elmo's fire or something."
But he had no idea of what St. Elmo's fire was. She could see that in his uncertain gaze. She settled again for telling him they couldn't hurt him, and indeed, this was the closest the Hobbs had ever come. Even as she looked back at them, they began to dance away, and soon most of them were gone. Perhaps she had thought them away. Once, she would have scoffed at such an idea, but no longer. Patrick began to relax.
"Why don't you go back to sleep, honey? You need to take your rest."
And she needed to take hers, but she dreaded it. Soon she would wake Roland, and sleep, and the dream would come. The ghosts of Jake and Eddie would look at her, more frantic than ever, wanting her to know something she didn't, couldn't know. Patrick shook his head.
"Not sleepy yet?"
He shook his head again.
"Well then, why don't you draw a while?"
Drawing always relaxed him. Patrick smiled and nodded, and went at once to Hofat for his current pad, walking in big, exaggerated sneak steps so as not to wake Roland. It made her smile. Patrick was always willing to draw. She guessed that one of the things that kept him alive in the basement of Dandelo's hut had been knowing that every now and then the rotten old fuck would give him a pad and one of the pencils. He was as much an addict as Eddie had been at his worst, she reflected, only Patrick's dope was a narrow line of graphite. He sat down and began to draw. Susanna resumed her watch, but soon felt a queer tingling all over her body, as if she were the one being watched. She thought of Mordred again, and then smiled, which hurt with the sore growing fat again it always did now. Not Mordred. Patrick. Patrick was watching her. Patrick was drawing her. She sat still for nearly 20 minutes, and then curiosity overcame her. For Patrick, 20 minutes would be long enough to do the Mona Lisa, and maybe St. Paul's Basilica in the background for good measure. That tingling sense was so queer, almost not a mental thing at all, but something physical. She went to him, but Patrick at first held the pad against his chest with unaccustomed shyness. But he wanted her to look. That was in his eyes. It was almost a love look, but she thought it was the drawn Susanna he'd fallen in love with.
"Come on, honey bunch," she said, and put a hand on the pad.
But she would not tug it away from him, not even if he wanted her to.
He was the artist. Let it be wholly his decision whether or not to show his work.
Please?
He held the pad against him a moment longer. Then, shyly, not looking at her, he held it out. She took it and looked down at herself. For a moment, she could hardly breathe, it was that good. The wide eyes, the high cheekbones, which her father had called those jewels of Ethiopia, the full lips which Eddie had so loved to kiss, it was her. It was her to the very life. But it was also more than her. She would never have thought love could shine with such perfect nakedness from the lines made with a pencil. But here that love was. Oh, say true, say so true. Love of the boy for the woman who had saved him, who had pulled him from the dark hole where he otherwise would surely have died. Love for her as a mother. Love for her as a woman.
Patrick, it's wonderful, she said.
He looked at her anxiously, doubtfully. Really? His eyes asked her. And she realized that only he, the poor, needy Patrick inside, who had lived with this ability all his life and so took it for granted, could doubt the simple beauty of what he had done. Drawing made him happy, this much he'd always known. That his pictures could make others happy, that idea would take some getting used to. She wondered again how long Dandolo had had him and how the mean old thing had come by Patrick in the first place. She supposed she'd never know. Meantime, it seemed very important to convince him of his own worth.
Yes, she said. Yes, it is wonderful. You're a fine artist, Patrick. Looking at this makes me feel good.
This time he forgot to hold his teeth together, and that smile, tongueless or not, was so wonderful she could have eaten it up. It made her fears and anxieties seem small and silly.
May I keep it?
Patrick nodded eagerly. He made a tearing motion with one hand, then pointed at her.
Yes, tear it off. Take it. Keep it.
She started to do so, then paused. His love and his pencil had made her beautiful. The only thing to spoil that beauty was the black splotch beside her mouth. She turned the drawing toward him, tapped the sore on it, then touched it on her own face, and winced. Even the lightest touch hurt.
"This is the only damned thing," she said.
He shrugged, raising his open hands to his shoulders, and she had to laugh. She did it softly so as not to wake Roland, but yes, she did have to laugh. A line from some old movie had occurred to her, "I paint what I see." Only this wasn't paint. And it suddenly occurred to her that he could take care of the rotten, ugly, painful thing, as it existed on paper, at least.
"Then she'll be my twin," she thought affectionately. "My better half, my pretty twin sis."
And suddenly, she understood. Everything? Understood everything? Yes, she would think much later, not in any coherent fashion that could be written down, if A plus B equals C, then C minus B equals A, and C minus A equals B, but yes, she understood everything, intuited everything. No wonder the dream Eddie and dream Jake had been impatient with her. It was so obvious. Patrick drawing her. Nor was this the first time she had been drawn. Roland had drawn her to his world with magic. Eddie had drawn her to himself with love, as had Jake.
Dear God, had she been here so long and been through so much without knowing what Quartet was, what it meant? Quartet was family. Quartet was love. To draw is to make a picture with a pencil or maybe charcoal. To draw is also to fascinate, to compel, and to bring forward. To bring one out of oneself.
The drawers were where Detta went to fulfill herself. Patrick, that tongueless boy genius, pent up in the wilderness, pent up in the drawers. And now? Now? Now he my for special, thought Susanna Odetta Detta, and reached into her pocket for the glass jar, knowing exactly what she was going to do and why she was going to do it.